The author of The Hakawati, which is a fantabulously pertinent modern Arabian Nights novel of such power that to read it is to synchronously encounter it in life. It happened twice. The art of the frame story, the story within the stories, is indeed a woven carpet that transports us across all borders of time, geography, self, and others. And his website is RabiaAlameddin.com. Welcome, Rabi.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's so wonderful. I am just waxing with unconflicted enthusiasm about this novel. My great friend Deborah, who lives in Syria, said, oh, you must find this novel. And I did, in a remote bookstore in a Delaware beach. There it was. And it has been my companion, kind of friend on many train, plane journeys, even though it's a hardback. You are joining us from Beirut. It is midnight where you are, so it's kind of perfect.
Uh-huh.
Midnight betwixt and between.
Yes, like we said, how cool is that?
It's completely cool. And again, mm-hmm. You live in San Francisco and Beirut, so again, crossing of borders and midnight between days, so that's great. One of your characters, Uncle Jihad, says, what happens is of little significance compared with the stories we tell ourselves about what happens. It's like, oh, that's really great. A friend of mine, I guess actually it was Deborah and Muawiyah from Syria, said that your name is a Druze name. Is that, that's true?
Yes, it is. It's an Arabic name, but we use it quite a lot. So you can find it in a lot of places.
And what my friend was also saying is that so Druze, or this syncretism, she said, mostly Muslim, elements of Gnostic Christianity, Kabbalistic, and the transmigration of souls. Reincarnation, pops up every now and then in your book.
Right. Well, the Druze are sort of a weird religion. We're an offshoot of the Shiite branch of Islam, but we shot a little bit too far, I guess. In the 13th century, they tried to unify all the religions, including Hinduism and Greek philosophy, and so to bring the world together. And instead of doing that, of course, they ended up creating a new religion that everybody hates.
Ah, yes, well put. Well, so we are dedicated certainly to, well, we're going to keep trying, right, with syncretism going,
It's all attempts at unifying is good. The trouble is what happens when you try to unify something is that you just create something new that distances itself from where it came from.
Yes, although again, multiple stories. One of our frame stories that we've been telling since the beginning of this year, well, probably forever, is Pluto, death, rebirth, underworld god. Will it figures prominently in your book, really. These journeys to the underworld and to death and to back, and that,
yes.
And demons becoming lovers and back and forth, and the light and the dark need each other. They are twins,
there's one and the same.
Yes, and we get into trouble when we try and get too pure or too demonic, yeah?
Yes, yeah. No, I use stories that have been told for thousands and thousands of years, and practically every culture tells the same story with minor variations. I think the trouble is that we get stuck on those variations instead of what is the basic story behind it. So the descent of the underworld is told in, I think, practically every culture, everywhere. I based it mainly on the Inanna myth, the Babylonian myth. But you could see it, in the descent of Demeter to save Persephone, Persephone keeping swallowing the three pomegranate seeds. It gets repeated all over. I always jokingly say that it's also the same myth as, the Aliens movie, Sigourney Weaver going into the bowels of the ship to fight, the mother alien. It's the same myth. It's the same story that we tell over and over and over.
Right.
The only difference is how we tell it.
Yes, and that is crucial. Again, the story within the story. I love that when Inanna gets back from the underworld, in some sequences, for her next trick, she actually restores culture. She sails with her Sukal to the island of the of the tyrannical king of wisdom who's stolen culture, called Maze, and she gets him drunk. Mm-hmm. It's like the bold women in your novel. She gets him drunk, and he gives her Maze, the art of writing and the art of kissing the phallus and the art of amusing the vulva, and anyway, she sails back.
Well, it's the same. I mean, the whole, this thing, that part of the story is also the Isis myth and with Osiris. So it's the same thing where, you know, she goes into the underworld, comes back, and then comes back with a lover or finds a lover, seduces a man, and he gives her everything. It's like I said, it's the same story. It's wherever you go, you'll find the exact same story. And we still tell those stories. It's just we like all great storytelling, it has variations.
Yes, but again, one of the things I do honor about the Hakawati, your novel, Stories Within Stories, is that I would read it every night, and then the next day I really would encounter it in real life. I was reading the story of, you know, Fatima's descent to the underworld, and the demon who is her antagonist and then her lover, and how she loses her hand and how the hand of Fatima comes to be. And the next day, and I was in Montana in the woods, I found three hands of Fatima, and I was like, oh, there it is.
Right. Isn't that lovely?
It is lovely. And then after that, when the Lord of Too Much Whiteness comes and takes away the demon lover and to the palace, I went to one of those too, where it was way too refined and demonically groovy.
Oh, you're saying that the Lord of the of you know, the White Lord, as I called him, Kincaid, and that was sort of a play on the painter Kincaid.
Ah,
the painter. He calls himself the painter of light, so basically I had him as a Batman.
Oh, that's very witty. Yeah. So this.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, no. This. Well, humor. I just saw Carrie Fisher's one woman show, which is quite adorable. But she begins it by saying, you know, if our stories weren't funny, they would just be true, and that's.
Oh. Yeah.
And that's no bargain at all. So.
No.
So what you're doing,
especially if you write, you know, especially if you write like I did, which is I intended to write like the Hakawatis of old in the Middle East, who basically used to tell stories that went on for you know, they could take a story for a year because they get fed basically on how long and how well they can keep a story. So they'd go into a cafe and they start a story, and if they do it well and people want them back, they get fed. So a storyteller can, Hakawati can tell it forever and ever. So I wanted a book that gives that feeling of being able to go on. So it had to be a long book. And for any long book to work, it must have a sense of humor. Otherwise, it can be deadly.
Oh, no, it's wonderful. And the cavalier phrases in different epics where then the phrase is thrown in, but he was of no more use to fate. Phoom, gone.
Yes. So,
well...
God sent the Mongols.
Yes. So I also was yearning with your Beirut San Francisco axis. You're weaving yourself as a story back and forth. What is the feeling in Beirut about the American election?
It's funny. I mean, obviously here there's. It seems sometimes that the whole world waits for what the election is. Some people in this part of the world, there's always conspiracy theories, and they feel that we're being set up, and that Obama has no chance of winning because something will happen. You know, the CIA won't let him, or whatever.
Right.
So I don't know. I really don't know how. Everybody will react to it. I'm worried, you know, but I'll be back in time to vote.
Oh, excellent. So you are a U.S. citizen?
Of course I am.
Of course you are. That's great. Being the
No, I've lived in San Francisco for about 31 years. So, but I spend about maybe, you know, between one quarter and half the year over here in Beirut. So it's a,
I think that
I'm citizens of both countries.
No, I think that's a wonderful way to do it. And in fact, a great friend of this show, Deborah Felmuth, spends half the year in Vermont and half the year in Damascus. And just as a sidebar whisper, if anybody wants to go to Syria with Deborah next spring, let me know and I'll pass on your request at CoyoteNetworkNews.com. It is. I think it's a crucial thing for Americans to travel either literally to the Middle East or through your book, The Hakawati. There's some great reviews your publicist sent me, which I think are all true. You know, but one says, a novelist builds a bridge to the Arab soul using the tradition of stories with a frame tale. I think that's true. I think that's fair enough.
I think that's really great. I mean, it's amazing. The reviews have been totally amazing. I think if somebody truly, truly wants to bridge find a bridge to the Arab soul, like, cross it and come over here. It's one of the, you know, one of the most amazing things is that it surprises me how little, when I'm in America, how little we know of the Arab world, and when I'm in the Arab world, how little we know of America. So that the best way to actually, sort of build the bridge is, you read my book, okay, but also just come and visit. You know, you'll be surprised at the welcome you get, and you'd be surprised how much you learn.
Yes, and I think it's one of the, in mythology, you know, we say where there's too much Mars, let there be Venus. Where there's this aggression, let there be cultural exchange and art and beauty. And one of the wonderful things, again, that runs through the Hakawati, your novel, is where there's Mars and warfare and bombing in Beirut, there's Osama, the main hero's mother, getting manicures in the midst of the war zone.
Right.
We go, Venus surviving no matter what, going, well, bombing, I must have my manicure. So again, that crucial where there's... But there are also, fantastically bold, erotic women in your novel, both modern, contemporary, and story, legend. And the men who develop enough strength to accept them as full partners, yeah?
True, and you know that part was one of the more interesting things about whether the mother getting a manicure the minute there was she was able to leave the house after being bombarded for the whole time. A lot of Americans just thought that was weird. The only people who understood it, of course, were Lebanese and Israelis, because they have the same thing. It's basically once there's a break, you know, we're getting a manicure. It is about. It's about storytelling, and there's a part in, I think the fourth book with saying that the best stories usually start with a woman, and it usually is the case where, you know, most of the great stories usually start with a woman, and she's either the prize or she's the heroine,
or the monster.
Me, I use both.
Yeah, well, but there's many monstrous, demonic, up to no good.
Oh. Absolutely,
and
they're the main, yes.
Yes, and we can but it's true, the arrival of the woman, and that's, again, as we could just sort of tease it, but not too much, you know, into the election cycle, we go, la, 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 whoa, there's a woman who's scary, who's changing the whole dynamic.
Now we can have a new story, can't we?
Exactly, we can have a new story, and then that's monstrous and distracting, and then a new story arises. But when you were asking backstage, you know, what is the purpose of your show, and I go, well, we like to do the story mythological news service so that we can understand, even in the phantasmagoria of illusion going on around us, the mythic forces at work. So I think your book, The Hakawati, is a good guide for that too.
Part of what I was interested in and what I tried to do in the novel is that it is a novel. I mean, I wanted to write a novel about a family. And so one of the things that I was interested in is how do we define ourselves? And one of the big things that a few of us really talk about is that really we are the stories we tell about ourselves. You know, like I as a person, I am the stories I tell myself about myself. And then, you know, as part of the family, I am... I'm the story that I tell about my family and where I fit in that family. And then I'm also part of a culture. So in that culture, I am the story that the culture tells. So we're surrounded by stories that define us. And until we begin to understand what these stories are, we could never understand either ourselves or another person. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, we're being bombarded by stories constantly. And we never know what part of the stories we're being told. So, I mean, if we only understood, for me, if we could only understand how storytelling works in politics, then we might be able to understand how to vote a little better.
Well, that's...
Because basically we're being told stories constantly from all sides, and how we describe these stories and which myths are being alluded to and what's true and what isn't is of extreme importance, and we just sometimes just get lost and we believe a story as opposed to another one.
Yes. Well, what we've been setting up in the last couple of weeks also is that America's great challenge and confusion in distinguishing between the con man and the trickster. You know, and the trickster is really the disruptor and liberator, such as yourself. And the con man looks like that, but is really not, you know. And so, you know, one of the characters in the story within the story within the story says, you know, in Europe, when the kings and queens and popes face, you know, economic or political problems, they launch a crusade. So it's important also that we, well, everywhere, understand that, which is the distraction, oh, war, look over there. You know, and again, that weaving of intimacy. But do you think, I was surprised to hear you say that you think that, say, your fellow Lebanese, which you call a country of Hakawatis, a country of storytellers, but that they know as little about Americans as Americans know about them. Is that really true?
No. Everybody knows a little bit more than Americans. Sometimes I think we Americans yes. tend to be a little bit too isolated.
Absolutely.
But they don't know as much as all we get from about America are usually either through Hollywood or through American policies, and that's not, you know, 1/100th of what America is. So, which is more than what America knows about the Arab world.
Yes,
I mean, that's part of the reason I call the narrator Osama, because for everybody, Osama is this evil man. Whereas Osama really is a very common name in our part of the world. You know, they're regular people.
No, I love that. I love that your hero is named Osama, and that his uncle is Uncle Jihad.
His gay uncle.
His gay uncle, yes, thank you, exactly. His gay uncle is Uncle Jihad. And, yeah, I think it's a great contribution to opening up, again, the American... whatever we want to call it, you know, when in traveling in Syria, of course, people were so happy. I mean, it is one of the most civilized places in the world. For Americans to be there going, oh, welcome, yes, change your direction, come this way, because they know what Americans have had to go through in terms of obfuscation to get there. And then in Turkey, I was always saying, you know, we Americans, we are a very simple, ill-educated people with no sense of history. Please excuse these questions. And it's true. So this exchange, you know, I often think that Arab culture can give, well, the power of the story, the power of resilience, the power of irony. What do you think that America needs, in a sense, culturally, the power of stories, irony, you know, from the Middle East? Where is this? What would the exchange be?
It's like, I don't know if it needs anything. You know, part of the trouble we sometimes, as Americans do, is we start putting as if America is in desperate need of something. What would be great for a lot of Americans and for Norwegians and for Lithuanians is to be open to other cultures. It's about mixing of cultures, and that, unfortunately, in the U.S., because we're such a big country and we're not surrounded by hundreds of neighbors, we tend to be very isolated. And so what is important is to be able to see other cultures. So I really suggest just, you know, travel as much as you can, read as much as you can, be open to different ways of living. Part of the thing that I find interesting is that without a mixing of culture, we tend to become static, and you know, being static a lot of the times leads to a lack of creativity and sort of early death, if you ask me.
Absolutely.
So what happens when Yeah, when we inject, when cultures meet, you know, they something new happens. Now, you know, in America's defense, I want to say I'm an American and I'm an Arab. So the mere fact that I am in America, even if I'm one person and, you know, the rest of the United States is 300 million, sort of changes the culture, just one person for a little bit. So that it happens, and it will happen more and more. Hopefully it'll happen quicker than it's been happening.
Well, I think that's why
it will happen.
I mean, everything real, everything symbolic, and so, you know, our left-wing progressive allies go, Obama, blah, 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 but nonetheless, he is a story, and he is a global citizen.
I mean, and we're, like I said, we'll move forward. It might take forever, but we'll move forward, and we'll tell stories. What I'm interested in is the important thing is just a little bit more openness, a little bit more from both sides. And again, I just spent a week at a conference in Norway, and you know what? Norwegians need to be a little bit more open as well, and Lithuanians and Mexicans and Pakistanis, and just to be open to other cultures, because it's fun. It's fun to read stories from other cultures. It's fun to find out, to see how different we are and how, at the same time, we're almost exactly the same.
Well, and the interweaving.
And
Go
ahead.
One
of the things that I'm interested in is that, you know, the whole idea of these stories that we tell, I mixed in all kinds of stories in the book. You know, what I used was everything from Homer to Ovid to the Arab writers, to Shakespeare, to Italo Calvino, to whatever, everything blended in together. Because basically, like I said, what I find fascinating is that underneath all, they're all the same story. So that there are differences, but when you look at the grander scheme of things, it's actually not that different. So that what the difference or the variation between, say, an American and an Arab, or a Norwegian and a Kenyan, is minor compared to what they have in common. And it's the variations, unfortunately, that get us that get us in trouble. And usually, the variations are emphasized when we don't see more variations.
Well, yeah, I mean, in this, you know, you do Isaac and Ishmael, one of the best tellings of that story, and they come together at the end, and, you know, that it can become demonic, but it is also the necessary experiment. You know, in the Grail legend, Percival can only attain the Grail and restore the waters of life when he finds his black Islamic twin brother, Ferfaz. You know, so there's we do need from each other. The reason I also brought up, you know, Obama's half sister was quoting the Arabian Nights and quoting Scheherazade about, again, the value of this experiment before us, exactly as you suggest. You know, to borrow, to expand, and like Scheherazade, I mean, she does not only save women and lands, but she saves even the tyrant who has murdered his own heart by expanding his vision through, you know, stories and eloquence. So,
And just as important, which in very few versions you get, which is she does have great sex. In most of the versions we get, it's a lot censored.
I read in your afterword. I have a number of Arabian Nights translations, but what is the uncensored one that you have? Is there one in English?
I believe there is one in English. It was translated recently. I read the one in Arabic, and it is fabulous. As in, a lot of the stories were actually sexual stories, and just pure sex that, for some reason, have... I wonder why they've been sort of censored.
Yeah, I wonder why. That's right.
I wonder why.
Right. And well, Sir Richard Burton's wife burned a lot of his translation upon his death because they were so bawdy and erotic, mm-hmm. although some of it sneaks through. But in your own book, at the very end, I guess, I want to bring up also the wonderful, wonderful word Majnun, but the emir's wife who's done terrible things, you know, whatever. But But it turns, the court turns into this bacchanal, and she says she's so beguiled by the number of positions and creativity and all kinds of things that, yeah, she's like, whoa. So that, yes, that broadening and excavating, I suppose, that sense of the incredibly exquisitely erotic stories of many cultures, but certainly the Middle East, which is not what the modern American mind thinks
not
of.
Not talked about.
Yes, excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also stories within stories. You know, that Osama, while at his father's deathbed, is reading Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, which is, alas, all too pertinent still about an American theocratic state rising up, and you know, but it has a good ending.
Oh,
I mean,
that's interesting. I never thought about it this way. Why didn't you think it was about the plight of women in the Middle East?
Why didn't I think it was that? Well, there you go. Of course, that's right. It is. You know, we excavate. It's like you are clearly, I think, a story archaeologist, which is excavate and bring alive by fresh telling, which is certainly in all traditions. That's how we bring the story alive through the fresh telling, and then it gets to run through the world as a living thing, right?
Yeah, no, it's also, I mean, there are many layers to the novel, which, I mean, I hope that, you know, a lot of readers get as much as they can out of the novel, but that it works on many different levels, and that's what good stories do. I mean, you can read or hear a story, and it works on the level of good storytelling, but it actually could be a lot deeper, and this is what you hope what every writer hopes his novel is.
Well, one of the reasons it took me so long to finish it, I started in August and I finished it about an hour ago, was I didn't really want it to end. I was like, oh, no. But then at the very end, I realized, oh, well, it doesn't end. And I'm going to read the whole thing again because it is... Because it is a...
But you also have to buy another book to read it again, okay? You have to... Through every reading, you have to buy another book.
Oh, yes, exactly. I will. That's right. No, and I will say to our pledge people out there that I do... You know, we've had many books on the show, and they've been pretty good, you know, but absolutely, you know, completely, sincerely, this is good. And I can't find it in my heart to loan it away, because I've bonded with it. Actually, it's physically beautiful, and it is a friend. And so I go, no, it's a wonderful book, but you'll have to buy your own copy. And so as we... You know, when we go to play, and I'll release you back into the, not yet, but in about 10 minutes, back into the midnight of Beirut, I'm going to say to people, you know, yes, pledge for yourself, but you won't want to give it away or loan it, really. Pledge another one as well for friends, anybody who loves story, life, richness, border crossing, all those crucial qualities. And full of tyrants that are pertinent, the ruthless fork-tongued megalomaniacs who rise to power through treachery and murder. That completely pertinent to now, God knows.
See, it's really funny because remember also you bring it back to the United States.
Yes.
But in the book, it's talking about Arab presidents.
Right. So similar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
are very similar. So yeah, you're getting my point.
Yes. Yes. No. Absolutely. I love your point. Going. Oh, it is the same. It is crucial. And we need these stories. And very often it is the stories of another culture that reveal one's own back and forth. Going.
Yeah.
Oh. Yes. I see
exactly.
That thing. But
exactly.
Good. Just for the thrill of it. You know, the opening lines. You know, listen. Would you just say those? Listen. Allow me to be the very.
Yeah? Listen. Listen, allow me to be your God. Let me take you on a journey beyond imagining. Let me tell you a story. How's that?
That's great. That's really
how cool is that? You're hearing this all the way from Beirut.
Yes.
You know, it's flying through the airwaves all the way to Beirut and then flying through the airwaves again.
And part of the wonderful romance of radio is that it keeps going on out into outer space, you know, forever. You know, hello, future, and past, and the spiraling back and forth. And I know this is a tedious question, but just for my own, how long did it take you to write this book? Because it is so crafted.
It took 8 years.
Good.
8 years.
Ah, one Venus cycle. Excellent.
Yeah,
because every 8 years, Venus is in the same relationship as she was 8 years previous to everything. So we go, Venus smiling on that. Yeah, that makes, because it is, you know, again, the story within story and your incredible organized you know, brewing of the thing within the thing, and the segues between modern and past so well done. So are you in your room? Were there stories on the wall? How did you keep them separate? Did they talk to each other?
No. Actually, I work almost exclusively all in my head. And it wasn't always so well organized. I mean, at one point it was a total mess. I didn't know what I had for a long, long, long time. But no, I usually work in my head. It's rare that I don't use graphs. I don't use outlines. I don't use. It's almost always in all of it is in my head until it's done, and then once it's done, I sometimes can't even remember my name, let alone the story itself.
Right.
But while I'm doing it for 8 years, everything was layered in my head, and it changes constantly. I mean, it's not. I never know what I'm doing next, so it's constantly being built, torn down, moved around, but it's almost always in my head. I actually rarely print it.
Oh really? So there's ancient legend Fatima, there's modern Fatima, there's Baybars,
mm-hmm.
And it's not like you have a pile of one story and then you shuffle them between each other. You're really writing it as you write it?
It gets shuffled as I write, and then once I finish the first draft, my first draft was 1,300 pages. So, you know, a lot of changes went into it once I finished the draft.
Right. But I think
from
also
1,300 pages down to 500 pages. So it was a lot of, actually, you know, work to just edit it. And, you know, I had a great editor that I worked with. A lot of work went into it. So it wasn't this perfect thing when it came out. A book never is. When I sat down to write in the first, I had all the stories going on in my head and the interrelationships of them. Then, you know, you start tweedling with this and tweaking this, and then, you know, this thing doesn't work, and this story needs to be put here because this is a much better place for it. Stuff like that happens afterwards.
Right, and then the layers also of pertinence, in which one of the characters says about Baybars that he's a marketing
and then
hero.
Which stories are really fabulous, but you know they don't add anything to the story, so you have to cut it out, just like that.
Well,
afterwards,
presumably it goes into compost for the next thing. I mean, aren't they?
Oh, I don't know. Everybody always says that. It actually for me never works that way.
Oh,
once they're gone, they're gone.
Really? You don't have a pile of outtakes, no?
No. I probably could. I mean, one of the things I used to do was whenever I finished a draft, because I was so afraid of losing it and it's so big, I would mail it online to myself, so it's always constantly in the Ethernet.
Yes.
So I'd have all these various. So at some point, I could probably get each version of it. But no, I don't. Once they're gone, I think once I cut them out, they're gone.
Well, I think that's part of the positive poignancy and melancholy that suffuses the stories too. That, you know, it is life and death at the very, you know, there is death and then new one being born. Beautiful phrases. In an ocean of grief, someone alights on a raft for a few moments. In a sense, that's your beautiful line. But it's in a sense that's the power of story. Yeah, that you get we get to land on a raft for a few moments.
We can talk about, you know, what stories mean. You know, for me, it's life is about stories. I mean, I told you that I think that it's how we define ourselves, but it's also. Stories bring a family together, they unite people, you know, what friends have in common is the stories that they tell each other about themselves. You know, what happens to friends, like, you know, my best friend and I, it's what happens to us is that story that keeps binding us, no matter, you know, what happens later. We keep people alive through stories, you know, it's like my father might be dead, but we talk about him. So whenever we talk about him, we keep him alive. The stories we tell of him keep him alive. And like Shahrazad, we can actually sort of keep death at bay by telling stories. So stories serve many, many, many functions.
Absolutely. Do you know the the wonderful, not the remake, but the original movie, Wings of Desire, Wim Wenders' movie?
It's one of my favorite movies.
Yes, well, again, because libraries are very close to your heart, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the storyteller in the library is one of the crucial themes, that it's the storyteller who holds culture. It's the stories that we have, exactly as you're saying, that we most need. The economy can go to hell, cities can be bombed, yep. But we need, it all becomes stories, and in the telling is really crucial.
And in my novel, the strongest bombing, they're in the bomb shelter, and they begin telling stories. At minimum, what stories are supposed to do is entertain. So, when I started writing this book, I thought, if nothing else, if I can just write a book that will entertain people, that's a great thing. And then you start from there, and then you begin to realize, oh no, stories can do a lot more than that. So, working with stories and what they can do is what makes for great storytelling and obviously great novels.
Yes, and again, your novel, which is a great novel, and it begins, listen to the story, and it ends exactly the same way. So there's also something in that, something so heartening in that symmetry going on, and the story continues. People may live and die, and the story keeps going, and it gets handed on, and that's part of the, crucial theme, I think, that suffuses, but also the wonderful ending, which is exactly as you said, we keep people alive by the power of their stories. And then I'm going to have to let you go pretty soon, but do you also know the movie Baba Aziz, The Prince Who Contemplated His Soul?
Sorry, could you say that again?
Do you know the movie? It's called Baba Aziz, The Prince Who Contemplated His Soul.
No, I don't know.
Well, it's international Arabic Persian collaboration. Very wonderful. If you loved Wings of Desire, you'll love this too. That's great. So I am on my way in to become a responsible fundraiser. I will let you go, but I love you at the very end. You say by nature a storyteller is a plagiarist. Everything one comes across. So is there a wish? Is there a wish or an exhortation for people to pledge, perhaps even on your way out, that you'd like to grant to us, oh storyteller?
A wish
for a genie, yes.
Let's just wish for an election with the right results.
Yes, election that makes a story that makes us laugh with delight.
And a story that makes us happy.
Yes, and bark. Yes, that's great. That's wonderful. Well, this has been a great delight to have you on from Beirut, as you say. How cool is that? It is completely
cool.
How cool
is that?
And maybe when you're back stateside, we can do a part two.
Great, that would be wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You are completely welcome. That's.